So you were up in Oregon.
I was up in Oregon. I was in the fabulous city of Portland for the XOXO Festival.
I'm jealous of both parts of that, going to Portland and XOXO.
It's really easy to make snotty jokes about Portland and talk about like how hip it is in kind of this derisive way. And most of those jokes are based on this element of truth.
Yeah.
But really, it was a fantastic city.
It wasn't as Portlandia describes it.
I haven't really watched Portlandia, and my understanding is that it's basically exactly like Portlandia describes it.
Okay.
But you kind of get into some of that, and it was unfair because I was there for a festival, so
yeah,
it was going to be significantly different because I was surrounded by out-of-towners as well. But the town itself had a lot of the same feeling of Minneapolis and St. Paul.
Okay.
Kind of like...
Whoa. You did that thing where you group Minneapolis and St. Paul.
No, okay, it's true, but I grouped them, and... It's true. It had a feeling of both of them.
Okay.
So, like, kind of the wider streets than you get in most big cities, because it's more spread out than most kind of densely populated American cities.
Yeah. Came around after the car.
It came around after the car. That's maybe the way to measure. It is, like, the buildings are generally smaller, or there are, like, areas you can be where they're, like, less dense, and so it feels... In, like, architecturally, kind of like the area around Minneapolis and St. Paul, different parts of Portland obviously feel like different parts of those. And then it's kind of like the hip and up-and-coming and youthful parts of St. Paul and Minneapolis are amplified a bit and then put into Portland.
Okay.
So it was really nice. It was kind of hot there. Not really a big fan of the hot temperatures.
Really?
It was a little sunny. Yeah, I know. It's like... supposed to be really rainy and fantastic, yeah. And instead it's like sunny and terrible.
God, I hate the rain. I love when it's cold and like misting, but if it's legitimate rain, I just sit inside.
You know, I feel like I told this story recently, but one of my favorite memories ever was that just torrential downpour where Ellen and I found you at the copy center, and we were going to the copy center.
Oh, yeah.
And you were at that coffee shop, and like We went in to talk to you, and then, like, right away, just this torrential rain started, and they were like, okay, everybody, we have to move into the back. And
yeah, and there's that black cloud just coming.
Get the hell out of here, and we ran down the street to one of our favorite Mexican restaurants and just, like, watched the rain pile up. And it's like the streets turned into rivers, and it was fantastic.
Yeah, it all happened so quick. That was pretty fun.
Yeah, that was so those are really, I really like that sort of thing. Obviously that is rare, and it's good that it's rare. Like,
yeah.
Living through that constantly wouldn't really be fun.
And the novelty.
Portland had really good weather. It was like, you know, sunny, warm, pretty perfect. I spent a fair amount of it inside because I was at this festival.
Yeah.
And you know, the festival was different than a lot of conferences I've been to because it was a little bit smaller. It was single track. So there's only one speaker at a time instead of multiple rooms with speakers that you can pick from.
Oh, and that's speakers, really nice.
Yeah, it's really nice, and also at times can be a little weird. Like, there's something nice about having that selection, except they did a good job of curating them and picking speakers that were interesting. And then a lot of the people that were speaking were clearly not used to speaking in front of large audiences. So, I mean, they're interesting and they were fun, but maybe it was like the first time they've presented in front of a big group like that at a talk or at a conference, so that was kind of interesting. A lot of them had 15-minute time slots, which is nice because, you know, you get enough information to kind of understand what the person is doing and how they're approaching it, but you don't really get bogged down in you know,
crap.
And I guess it's pretty rare to be at a conference where people are filling time or you really feel like they're filling time.
I think it helps, like you said, if you haven't spoke before at those conferences. The 15-minute time slot, if anything, helps the speaker more than the audience.
Yeah, that's probably true. And then, like, the first day there was a welcome party, and then that was just, like, the night before. It was, like, a Thursday night. And then Friday during the day, there was a welcome address in the morning, and then there were parties kind of scattered throughout the day at different places. And so Panic, which is one of the best Mac app, probably the best Mac app developer, they've been developing Mac apps since long, long before the resurgence of Apple. They hosted some stuff. It was the first time they've ever done kind of an open house where people can come in and see their office, which was pretty cool.
Yeah,
and then we got to go to Wieden Kennedy. They had a party on their roof. Wieden Kennedy being like the most well-known advertising agency in Portland, and actually, I mean, a really well-known.
I'd say Pacific Northwest, probably for sure.
Yeah, they're pretty great. There was a bar that had like 60 different arcade games set to free play, so you could just go in and play whatever
at their party.
So it was just like, I mean, it was kind of in between the main conference area and Panic and Wieden Kennedy, and it was kind of happening at the same time. So it was like on your way to or from either of those parties, you could stop off at this bar and play arcade games, and it was fantastic. You know,
that is
classic.
Awesome.
They had a lot of classic games that had been well maintained, and then they had a lot of the newer pinball machines that have, you know, super crazy lights and flashing. And you forget when you're around pinball that pinball really needs sound.
Yeah.
And since there were like a dozen machines next to each other, they had the sound turned off or maybe really quiet.
Yeah.
And it made it a little less fun.
Yeah, I think it'd be pretty boring because, I mean, you do it for the like boing.
Yeah.
Sound, I mean, you're getting, and the,
you still get the mechanical sound of it hitting things, which is cool, but yeah, that really loud. Or like you play the Simpsons pinball and you want to hear all those cheesy catches over and over again. Like that's the whole point of the game, is just to hear your favorite lines.
Yeah. Do you remember, this is an arcade game that I used to play all the time at a pizza place that was in my town growing up, and it was Simpsons, but also kind of like Rampage, except with Simpsons.
So, yeah, that's just called, like, the Simpsons game, isn't
yeah,
it?
That yeah. was such a good game. Like, why'd they stop making that? Or why don't more people put that in their arcades?
So, that, I mean, if you have an arcade, you should have that game. It's one of the best.
Yeah.
Are you aware that you can get that game for iPhone?
I am.
Okay. They cut out some of the characters, right?
Yeah.
Like, you can only play as Homer, and then you get to play as the other characters for special moves. Like, you grab a donut, and then you can play the special characters. It's actually a really fun iPhone game.
Yeah, I played it on my brother's phone, but I haven't, or my brother's wife's phone, I think. I don't know. Somebody's phone I used, but I haven't downloaded it just because, I don't know. I don't play a lot of games on my phone. So.
Yeah, there was an indie arcade later in the night at XOXO, which was where a bunch of game developers kind of just, like, they had this warehouse space that looked like it had never been used for anything or hadn't been used for anything in the last decade.
Mm-hmm.
And they set up some projectors and they had, you know, their games available to play. Was really excited because Big Bucket, which is the group that makes The Incident, which is one of my favorite iPhone games, was showing off their new game. It's a ways out yet, but it's going to be kind of a tactical adventure game. I was excited to see that. There was also this really fascinating game that used the PlayStation Move controller.
What?
It's like the Wiimote, but it's got that like incandescent ball on top.
Yeah.
And it glows, right? So they had hacked together this game, and it was essentially like a group of five or six people would hold the controller in one hand, and they would just kind of hold it up like they were holding a candle, and then there was some nice orchestral music in the background. And the way the game worked was you couldn't move your controller quickly. Like, if you moved it really at all, it would flash and you'd be out. So you had to, or you could move like really slowly and steadily.
Yeah.
And so the point was to like slap your opponent's hands to get them to move quickly. Without moving your backhand a lot. So it was kind of like this like really crazy knife fight where like you have to hold the other person's hand and then in your other hand you've got a knife, so like it's like that sort of game, but kind of reversed and obviously a little bit less violent.
Yeah,
there were still some people falling down.
That sounds really fun, actually.
Yeah, that was a pretty sweet game.
I feel like you could play that game with the candle.
Yeah,
it's
maybe just a game that was played like if you were outside and you were playing it with a candle, you probably wouldn't really get hurt.
I'm more worried about, like, if you were really good and you let it burn for a while and the wax got you.
Yeah, you might want, if you were wearing, like, a wax-proof glove, that might help.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I doubt anyone would hold it for that long, but, or put just, like, a little, like, catch reservoir around it.
Yeah, or just use the hot burning, low burning wax where the wax just disappears.
Yeah, I'm interested.
The main disadvantage of those candles is that they burn faster, right?
Yeah.
So which wouldn't really be a problem because you don't really care.
No.
Yeah.
Huh.
So the main point of the conference was to kind of bring people that create things online together with other people that create things online, or the people that make the platforms for creating things online.
Mm-hmm.
And the keynote speaker the first day of talks was Dan Harmon, who's the creator of Community.
Yep.
And he's also done some other projects.
I saw that link you posted the other day.
Yeah. So that was, I posted a link to an unaired pilot that he did with Ben Stiller and Jack Black in the 90s. It was a show called Heat Vision and Jack. And so I didn't know this going into it, but he explained it before they aired it, and it helped a lot. His point was that he moved to L.A. with his partner, his writing partner, and they were trying to write movies, and they weren't having much luck, so they pitched this TV show, where they were pitching movies to Ben Stiller, and he didn't like any of them because they were all terrible.
Yeah.
He's like, well, why don't you pitch a TV show? And he's like, well, that's a terrible idea. And then later, like, after Ben just like, yeah, that's a terrible idea for a show. Get out of here. And later, like a couple weeks later, Ben Stiller called him and was like, hey, I was in this meeting with these executives at whatever movie studio or television studio, and they were asking me for ideas, and I pitched your idea, and they liked it, so now you got to make an episode.
Cause what an asshole.
He couldn't think of anything on the spot, so he had to pitch. So they went in, and they pitched, and they were, like, accepted, and they're like, oh, crap, like, this crappy idea. Like, we got to do this now. And then the person, whatever agent or whoever accepted their pitch, was later fired, but they still had a contract. And so the contract was structured such that they just had to keep pitching until they had to pitch ideas until they were told something was a good, like, something was successful.
Yeah.
So they kept pitching ideas, and it was like this big burden, and they were, you know, really snotty and didn't want to work in television. So they realized that they could get out of their contract if they wrote a script, like an entire pilot script, and it was, you know, if it was told, no, you can't film that, it's too bad.
Yeah.
So they wrote this show in, like, a weekend. They wrote this show called Heat Vision and Jack. And the premise of this show was that there's this astronaut who flew too close to the sun, and so he became the world's smartest man, but only when he's in sunlight. And then he and his motorcycle, who is actually his roommate, like, his roommate's mind has been put inside of a motorcycle, go around solving mysteries and crimes and such.
I was just surprised that it didn't run for 10 seasons.
Yeah, it was it was really bad.
Yeah.
Very campy, pretty funny. It was enjoyable.
It was funny in kind of a bad way.
Yeah, yeah. And so they pitched it, and we're obviously told, no, that's the worst idea we've ever heard. But then later, Ben Stiller was like, well, that's kind of funny. We should actually film that. And so then they got together and made this episode, and it was a lot more fun to watch it in a huge group of people with a creator there to, like, answer questions about it.
Oh, yeah.
I don't know if it's actually worth watching outside of that, but we will, of course, include
I watched the link that you...
Yeah, did you like it?
I mean, it was funny in sort of a bad way, especially, you know, because it had that connection to Community, and I like TV, so...
Yeah.
Found it more interesting than entertaining, I guess.
So Dan Harmon's keynote, he didn't talk too much about Community,
because
he was, of course, just fired from it.
He was?
Yeah. Did you not understand?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
I've been trying to follow how that whole thing worked out with him and Chevy Chase.
So it doesn't actually have to do with Chevy Chase, although my understanding is that they all want to fire Chevy Chase.
Mm-hmm.
I don't really know or care about that, because it's, you know, actors gonna be bratty. That's outside of my wheelhouse.
Yeah.
But what he said in his keynote was that he was fired because they wanted to make more money, which makes sense.
I think that show, the issue with it is it would have been great for one or two seasons, and they just started, like, they're like, oh, a bunch of people are watching it, and they just tried to suck every dime out of it. And you can't have a show about a community college where people are getting two-year degrees and make it last for four seasons.
They only ever take one class per season, though.
Or no, so, they take one class together.
Yeah, I know that the point of the show is that it's like this misfit group is taking one class together, and then you see their exploits inside. But I mean, it's a sitcom, so you can just kind of suspend your disbelief for that, as long as the show stays good. What he said was that he and, like, basically all of the other high-level staff of the show were up for contract renegotiations.
Oh,
and
yeah.
Instead of even bothering to rehire or try to rehire or get some deal, they essentially just fired everyone and hired a new staff. And I think they did that under the knowledge they would run like one more season or something.
Yeah.
So he was obviously bitter and funny about being fired during his keynote, but his main point was that the internet is free of the tyranny of money because there's no good way to monetize things. And so since there isn't a good monetization strategy, the studios are all staying with television and movies and such, so we are free, and he was talking to the XOXO audience here, we are free to make good content online and, like, do what we want because, there's less oversight and there's less money and greed. And it was really interesting, and it was also, like, this strangely pessimistic keynote, which made it very funny and kind of surreal.
Yeah. We were discussing that same idea in the theories of art history that class I'm taking,
yep.
Where there's a writing by Michel Foucault from early 20th century, and he talks about how with the beginning of film, how he, like, right away he thought that film and, like, movies were going to become this great utopian art form. Because there was, like, no... It was all about the collective organization. But mm-hmm. then we see what happens is, you know, like, the directors start getting their name on things. Actors start getting their name on things. Money gets involved. And sort of, like, it was kind of depressing because the whole class was like, whoa, that didn't work out like he thought. And then I was like, hey, you guys, have you heard of the internet? Like, I was just like, anybody can put anything out there. Like, no one needs to... I'm like... I have a podcast, and nobody stops that. You know, like, it's not controlled by money anymore if you just go do it.
Yeah.
I mean, you won't make money as easily.
Yeah, as easily, but then part of the joy of it is that people are in the things to kind of create something they like.
Yeah.
And, you know, making money. There were other talks that were really good. About ways to make money online or the importance of making money online. The CEO of Etsy spoke quite a bit.
Oh, yeah.
He had not a keynote, but he had a longer block of time. And he was really interesting, and he had lots of great stories that he shared of people that had started making their crafts on Etsy and then just quit their jobs because they could work full-time selling things on Etsy. Like, this idea that is the structure that he was able to provide a platform where people could have creative control of what they were doing but still make money and support mm-hmm. themselves was really fascinating and a nice kind of change from Dan Harmon's super pessimistic but very funny stance on it. You know, and since we're on the topic of money, this might be a good time to transition into some follow-up that we have.
Yeah.
There was some interesting stuff sent in specifically regarding the 5-hour energy commercial that we talked about last week.
Yeah, we got quite a bit of interest about that.
Yeah, it partially because we kind of disagreed. I think having Owen's voice helped spur some of that interest.
Yeah.
This article I have that a reader sent in, this was the best part that was sent in, the best feedback, was from the Economic Times. It's an article from April 10th, 2012. And I can't pronounce his name properly, but Manoj Bhargava. The richest Indian in U.S. commits 90% of earnings to charity is the title. And so it's just an article about how the CEO of 5-Hour Energy is this really frugal guy, and he is kind of, or he's committed to donate 90% of his money to charity, and he's setting up some Indian charities to do that. And like, you know, it was really nice to read. It's really cool to see a CEO of a big company doing something that is...
Just the fact that he's as wealthy as he is and he's so kind of unknown and floats under the radar is pretty neat.
Yeah. This article also has some of the economic information about the business. It says 5-Hour Energy is a 2-ounce energy drink in red and yellow bottle, which controls 90% of the U.S. energy shot market, with retail sales estimated at $1 billion.
Jeez.
And that is just 8 years after 5-Hour's launch in 2003. So, like, that's a pretty meteoric success story for selling products in convenience stores. I mean, yeah. we've had other companies recently kind of explode onto the scene, but to do it like this company did is pretty amazing.
Yeah, and I think they've lasted a little bit longer than a lot of the ones that grow quickly like that, you know?
Yeah. So they've been around for 8 years, and they're super successful, and they didn't, you know, they weren't successful for 6 months. Like, they've been successful for most of that 8 years. It also goes on to detail his frugal lifestyle and humble behavior, because he spent 12 years in his life in monasteries, and he spends a lot of time kind of meditating or in contemplative silence. I shouldn't necessarily say he's meditating, because they can be different. Yeah. And I think that kind of gives us a picture of why the commercials look the way they do.
Yeah, I think he doesn't want to waste his money on things that are flashy.
Yeah,
so he's not going to waste money, his company.
I think time as well.
Yes. However, I'm going to again place the argument that, is it a waste of money? If you make more money because you have better ads, you have more to give to charity.
So I mean,
it's a double-edged sword.
If you make more money because you spent more on ads, then obviously, like, if the cost of the ad is outweighed by the benefit of your returns, then obviously it's better to do the better ad. I'm thinking that he doesn't care because they're successful the way they are.
Yeah.
And I don't think he wants to, like, have excess.
That's true, because even if you make, you know, $3 million more by spending $1 million more on ads, he's still just going to give it away. And so he's fine either way, you know? It's still $1 billion.
Yeah, there's probably an element of that. But I think it's more just like in these tightly run companies that are very successful,
mm-hmm.
the taste of the CEO guides the taste of the entire company.
Yeah.
And so you can see that with companies that are on the scene right now. Obviously, Apple is a huge example of that. And you see it across the tech industry that Amazon's CEO is very strong-willed, and so the company kind of follows his direction.
Yeah.
I think you could easily say this guy is really, really strong-willed and has a specific lifestyle, and then that is translated into every element of the product. So it's a product that's about being simple, and then their advertising is also somewhat simple and rudimentary and gets the job done, explains what it is, but is not, you know, kind of excessive.
Yeah. I think that especially with a company like this, I'm sure he also, when he started the company, probably surrounded himself with people with similar ideas, similar goals for the company, and that's why it has worked, you know? Like, if you were to pair up with you and I, we probably would stop doing business within the first 6 months.
Yeah, we would have taken it a very different direction.
I would have said, hey, dude, stop sitting around being quiet. We have a business to run.
Yeah.
Stop contemplating over there and start doing something. What? You don't have anything to talk about? We'll just make a podcast and talk about nothing.
Yeah, that's probably... So that was some interesting follow-up. I'm going to put a link to that in the show notes, which, of course, can be found at verbmill.net/thewhitehorsecourier. And then this is episode 5. So if you add /5, you'll get specifically this episode's page, where we'll have links to everything that we talk about.
It's pretty.
As well as the commercial that we're going to talk about today.
If that gets to be, you know, too many slashes, it's a pretty
clean. So if you just go to
verbmill.net,
it's easy to find. Verbmill.net will take you there.
It's designed pretty well.
Thank you. But, you know, we've got some big stuff planned for it, and some things are going to be changing around on it, but it is working right now. We've had a lot of problems our first few weeks with getting the site and streaming and the podcast in iTunes all together. All of it was kind of shaky. It seems stable now, so feel free to download the episode as many times as you want, because it should keep working.
Yep, and we still seem to be in the iTunes store if something happens with the streaming online. So,
and, you know, if people want to help out, there's a few things they can do. The iTunes music store is one of the best ways they can help. Just go to iTunes, search for The White Horse Courier. Obviously, subscribe if you're not already subscribed. But leave a rating and leave a review. You can be honest. If you don't like it, leave a bad one. We'd prefer you, obviously, to leave just nothing but 5 stars. But that will help us kind of expand our audience. It helps us get featured in iTunes, or helps us kind of come higher up in search rankings.
Helps us make our show kind of push it in the right direction.
Yeah.
You know, if we get a lot of bad reviews, we'll have to go back to the drawing board. Well, we won't, though. They'll like it.
So let's go on to the commercial for this week. I am going to start this commercial, and then I'm going to introduce it.
Okay.
Pioneers. Oh, pioneers. Come, my tan-faced children. Follow well in order. Get your weapons ready. Have you your pistols? Have you your sharp-edged axes, pioneers, oh, pioneers? For we cannot tarry here. We must march, my darlings. We must bear the brunt of danger. We, the youthful, sinewy races, all the rest on us depend. Pioneers, oh, pioneers. Oh, you youths, Western youths, so impatient, full of action, full of manly pride and friendship. Plain I see you, Western youths. See you tramping with the foremost. Pioneers, oh, pioneers. We debouch upon a newer, mightier world, varied world. Fresh and strong the world we seize. Pioneers. Oh, pioneers.
Do you think anyone could guess what that is for without already knowing?
I don't really think so. But I think that as the ad goes on, it intrigues you enough to know it's something to do with style. Something about image. And it's intriguing enough that you're going to want to watch all the way till you see that Levi's logo at the end.
Yep. And if you're watching it and paying attention, you can guess that it's Levi's earlier because it's the only brand name you see.
Yeah.
And, like, there's a couple shots of people, like, putting pants on and they're like, very well manicured or, like, just a little red tag comes up. Yep. But you're exactly right. Like, the goal of this commercial is to show style and show taste and create a lifestyle.
And they killed it on that aspect, I would say.
Yeah.
I want to be a pioneer.
Yeah. So pick this commercial for a couple of reasons. One is that it's a Wieden Kennedy commercial, and I was just in Portland at Wieden Kennedy, so it seemed appropriate.
Thanks, guys.
Another is that I think this is the exact opposite in terms of technical, you know, technical features of a commercial of the 5-Hour Energy commercial.
Yeah.
Like, 5-Hour Energy is all about product. It's not about lifestyle. It's about product. And it's got zero flash.
There's a shot.
This is all about lifestyle, and it's got tons and tons of flash.
Yeah, like, there is where I'm going to find it. I'm going to give them the exact minute. There's a shot in here.
An exact second would work better because the commercial is only a minute.
Cool your jets there, champ. Okay, it's at right at 10 seconds. There's a shot of a blonde woman in a tank top. Cannot see her jeans at all. And she's just staring at the camera. And then it's like the big bright flash in her face and everything else is dark around it. And, like, as somebody who studies photography and enjoys photography, this is one of my probably favorite portraits I've ever seen on a commercial level. Like, not in a commercial even, but just an advertising photo or, like, compositionally. She's sitting there just staring right at you. It's so intense. Like, and it just flashes for, like, a second. And you're like, whoa, I want to feel whatever. Like, I don't really even know what she's feeling, but I want to be there taking that picture or standing next to her.
It reads to me, I'm looking at it too, and I've got it at 9 seconds in.
Okay.
It reads to me as very similar to the American Apparel ads.
But, like, seems less objectified.
Yes, that's true. American Apparel does a similar thing with, like, very skinny people that are kind of red in the face and sweaty, and, like, their hair is not well kept at the time, or, like, they're not super styled hair. This does not really seem to be objectifying her, like
no.
You said.
But it does have that same style that Terry Richardson, the guy that does most of the photography for American Apparel, uses, you know? That bright.
And yeah, that like bright and like half fully saturated and half, like half of the commercial is like really saturated and half of it's kind of like filtered back to be very yellow. super, super hip right now. I think that kind of reads to me a lot as Portland, and it has that feel of, like, the youth are rebelling, kind of like we're this, like, the counterculture that exists right now really fits with this commercial and really fits with Portland. I think I can understand how this commercial came out of White and Kennedy. I'm a little bit surprised, actually, that it came from Levi's.
I'm not. I'm like, I think maybe it's that I have this, that maybe because I've been watching these ads and seeing some of the print media they've made, and I've sort of been thinking that way, but I think Levi's has sort of, in a way, always been a little bit ahead of the curve.
Okay.
You know, I think they're one of the only clothing brands that have always, I mean, they haven't been like the top, most famous, all the cool kids are wearing it clothes, but they have stayed within probably the top five most popular clothing brands with every trend. You know, I mean, people in the 80s were wearing Levi's, people in the 90s, I mean, we had other things we wore too, but I mean, everybody, every generation has owned a pair of Levi's.
Yeah, that makes sense.
You know,
part of it is because what they're making is not, you know, super stylish.
No,
but it is
pretty timeless.
Kind of, yeah. Not, I mean, when I said it's not super stylish, you could interpret that to be me saying like it's kind of ugly, but it's more that they're not trying to rest on the laurels of style, but rather making a product that can be changed in little ways to kind of give it more longevity. Yeah. I've got this article from Brand Channel, which is a website dedicated to advertising and brand. So if you're interested in this podcast, you're definitely going to be interested in brandchannel.com. Obviously, link in the show notes. It talks a lot about how Levi is trying to turn into a global brand because they had been kind of America central, U.S. central, as most U.S. companies are. And it talks about a couple of key people that were hired at Levi's and their work on the Nike's Just Do It campaign. And then they also worked with Apple on the iPhone campaign. Which it shows you how, like, the company has enough taste to hire people that make these massively successful, fantastic advertising campaigns. And that's why, you know, obviously that kind of bled into Levi's, or they were looking for that, and so they brought that in to kind of revitalize it. The commercial is obviously just simple text being read to the audience, and it's shots of young people doing young things in a very stylistic way. So they're, you know, campfires, they're running, they're riding in cars with their hand out the window, just kind of enjoying life. And they're somewhat aggressive, like they're all kind of active things that are pushing, or they're fire, you know, but they're not really, they're not violent in any way, and they're not aggressive in any negative sort of way.
No.
The poem used in this ad is Walt Whitman's poem, Pioneers, Oh Pioneers. And it's actually from a recording by Will Gear, who was an actor in, like, the 40s to 60s-ish. The poem was published in 1865. Will Gear was an actor in the mid-1900s. He was blacklisted in the early 50s for not, you know, outing his communist-sympathizing friends.
Yeah.
So, like, the heritage of this ad really kind of follows along a very specific path. It's this I always think of James Fenimore Cooper. It's this Walt Whitman poem about westward expansion and about, like, the youth rebelling and taking over. And of course that comes from the mid 1800s. It comes from the gold rush. It comes from a time when denim became a fabric that was used for things. And then it's being read by a guy in the 50s during this time of like youthful rebellion again, and kind of this idea that like people can kind of impact things in a bigger way, and then it's a message delivered in like the mid 2000s about how pants are going to help you do that.
Yeah,
right. Like the commercial itself as a piece of art, if it was divorced from advertising, would be very successful.
Yeah, and I think that one of the things that works great about it is that connection and connecting Levi jeans to the timelessness of them. You know, the message that Walt Whitman was talking about, the message that was, you know, going on in the 50s. I mean, every generation has felt that rebellion, and it's been very similar. You know, whatever the struggle was, the youth acted in a very similar way. And I think that associating their genes with that timeless idea makes their brand more timeless. It makes their brand seem like it was part of, you know, all of that.
Yeah. So, there's tons we could talk about here. I mean, we really could pick anything to talk about in this ad and spend a lot of time on it. But instead of kind of trying to hit everything, I think what we should do is jump into this case study that I found.
Yeah, the positives and negatives of it all.
Yeah, so this is from Lisa Wong, who works at Deutsch Inc. She's an account executive at Deutsch Inc., which is a Seattle-based advertising agency. And I'm going to put the link in the show notes, but we can just basically read it to you as well. It's slides that are done as a case study of this advertising campaign. And the first slide that I want to talk about is slide number 3. It's Levi's campaign brand values. And if you're outside of the world of design and advertising, brand values usually seem really, really douchey, right?
Yeah.
Am I right in saying that? Yeah.
So I would assume like, so.
Generally, it's like we're going to make a list of words that are going to define our brand. So it's like cutting edge, fast moving, blah, blah, blah. You know, they seem really douchey. But then as soon as you start to use them correctly, or if they're used effectively by people that know what they're doing, they really can define not only the platform for advertising, but the creation of the product and the target market.
Yeah. I think their word choice and their brand values and the way they sort of pushed it into like their main, you know, go forth makes so much sense to me. You know?
So yeah, that makes sense, and it fits right in with their brand values. That, I mean, essentially once you decide these keywords, you can often just like sit back and everything else makes itself.
Yep.
So the first words are pioneers/pioneering. And then it's work, workers, working, America, American, Americana, frontier, equality, freedom, youth, revolutionary, independence. Like, these are all words that are really lofty and big. And if you said, I'm going to describe my pants as free and as equality, like Levi's
revolutionary.
Equality, revolutionary. Like, you sound like a huge jackass.
The other thing that I think they did a nice job is a lot of times we hear these words, equality, American, work, freedom, and we associate this like idea of the American go buy my guns and drive my big truck, sort of this diluted sense of what America means and what equality means and what freedom means. And I think they did a good job of using those words without having that diluted, disgusting sense of what America has become when you see it in red, white, and blue on a t-shirt.
Yeah, that is a hugely important observation, that like their choice of Walt Whitman as a poet to define America is not a unique choice.
No.
But it is a choice that is, I mean, it's a good choice, obviously. It's a choice that I think a lot of companies and a lot of people would kind of abhor right now. I think a political party right now, one of the big ones, would really hate the idea of using poems by Walt Whitman because they are, you know, different from a lot of current values.
Mm-hmm.
And so this commercial is not necessarily like pro-socialism, but it is in some ways kind of building on the success of the progressive movement.
Yeah. Using recordings from blacklisted actors.
Yeah.
That's another big...
So, you know, there's going to be one... we're going to ask a lot of questions of the listeners this week. The first question I want to ask is it okay to co-opt poetry for advertising? And is it okay to co-opt, like, famous actors and like, artistic works for advertising?
And
I'd like our listeners to email in with that. You can just email...
Tell them to tweet at us.
Yeah, okay.
Let's do that.
So I'd like our listeners to respond to the question. You can just tweet at us or email team@thewhitehorsecourier.com and let us know what you think about that. And we're going to we're going to think about it some more for next week and kind of have more of a discussion of using poetry in advertising or using art. Existing created art in advertising.
Especially when the artist is already dead.
Yeah. You know? That's an important thing.
Because I'm curious about to explore the ideas of what Walt Whitman would think. Mm-hmm. So
there's also interesting topics, not to get on too much of a tangent, but a lot of times musicians will record songs under major labels and they won't own those songs anymore. The labels do.
Yeah.
And then the labels sell them to advertisers and the musicians are pissed off.
Mm-hmm.
I think current musicians are smarter about that and they realize that they need to retain ownership or structure it in a way that their songs can't be used in places they don't like.
Yeah.
But that certainly happens.
Just too bad.
So that's how brand values works. This is how the words that kind of make up your brand value guide both the product and the brand and how you're going to market it, who you're going to market it to. Mm-hmm. Youth is obviously one of the biggest ones here. Levi's is trying to hit, you know, people that are age like 13 to 26 or so. Like this is kind of their sweet spot. Like people that are young or maybe just people that want to be young.
Yeah.
So basically everyone, but in a very specific way.
Yeah.
The next slide that I want to talk about is Lisa Wong's slide 6, which her title is Campaign Results, Pluses and Minuses. And she's writing about, or this slide is about the entire campaign, not just this commercial. But a few of her minuses, I think, are interesting and they stick out. Specifically, one of them that is from Ad Age, where they said it was too cleverly manufactured. So that's going to be the second question we're asking people.
Can something be too cleverly manufactured?
And I think it certainly can be. I think there are circumstances where ads are like a little too clever for their own good or clearly like co-opting culture. But I want to know if our listeners actually think that this is too cleverly manufactured. Is this kind of the exact opposite of the 5-hour energy ad and in a bad way where it's like there is too much, it's too heavy-handed and the advertisers are like trying to force too much of something mm-hmm. that's not theirs into it, which is like too much of this youth culture into it to really kind of appeal? Or is that unfair? And so I'm interested in seeing where that goes, and I think we're going to talk about Levi's again next week, so I think we can probably save the discussion of whether or not it's too cleverly manufactured. But that's a question I want our listeners to answer.
Yeah. I think some of the other criticisms are a little bit unnecessary as far as it applies to the ad.
Like which one? Well, like, I mean, which one do you disagree with?
Well, I mean, I disagree with the no U.S. factories.
Because oh, okay.
I don't think anybody in their target market cares about that anymore.
I bet a lot of youth do care about that.
Okay, I bet they care about the jobs and they care about industry. But I'm curious to know how many 13 to 26 year olds are planning to or currently working in a denim manufacturing factory.
So it's true that many of them maybe don't want to work in denim manufacturing, but I think people in this age group really do care about where things are sourced.
Yeah.
And obviously this is coming out of an advertising agency in Portland where, you know, everything is locally sourced and everyone cares, mm-hmm. you know. I think that is something that people care about. This Lisa Wong was using that as a criticism of the entire campaign and it has to do a lot with their print ads, I think.
But I think we care about what Levi is doing in whatever countries they have their factories. You know, I think that if Levi's is underpaying and poorly treating their employees in India, Indonesia, other countries that sort of have this market for tons of labor. But I don't necessarily care that they do it in America because I have this selfish American idea where I don't want to work in a factory.
Yeah, I mean, that's kind of outside of the ad itself.
Mm-hmm. I just don't think it's a problem. Like, they're an they are a U.S. company.
So can they sell this American
image,
idea, and image and culture without actually making the product in America?
Yeah, but they're designing the product in America. So are they, just because they're manufacturing it somewhere else, does it mean that it's made some? I don't know.
You know, that could actually tie in then with the too cleverly manufactured.
Yeah.
Because I don't necessarily disagree with you, but I think there is some interesting discussion there. Like, if they're advertising this as an American product for Americans and it's like, go forth and be bold, then making them in America would be part of that. But I don't necessarily think that they're not specifically saying like, America, go America, as much as they're saying like, youth, be youthful. And it is something that they were using on a global scale.
Yeah.
And I don't think anybody cares in any other part of the world whether or not the pants they got were made in America.
No.
So that's interesting. The next minus that she has is confusion of taglines. Go forth, we are all workers, and oh, pioneer.
Mm-hmm.
Obviously, the tagline that like sticks out here is go forth, and that is used in more of their commercials. Oh, pioneer is not really, but I think this is a fair criticism that like that line is so, or that poem is so iconic and has so many great lines that it kind of like they conflict with each other.
Yeah.
And then the final criticism, which is a criticism that it happens on almost every good television commercial, is that it is a loose brand connection.
Yep.
Like, you could basically make this about any product that can be described as like lifestyle and you know, youthful, and it would be the exact same ad, except instead of like a shot of Levi's, you would use a shot of whatever t-shirt or whatever car or whatever shoes or whatever food, whatever soft drink. It could be anything.
I think it's hard, a little bit harder, because just like we talked about, the thing about jeans being a little bit more subtle when they're wearing them, like, it's hard to advertise a watch and like show some shots of the watch, but you know, like, you'll notice, hey, all those guys have really nice watches on.
Yeah.
But when you see everybody wearing jeans, it looks normal. So it's easier to sell the lifestyle before the product.
I don't think this is too loose of a brand connection because of the stuff we've already talked about with like jeans kind of being this American institution. But also, I think you're exactly right that like this commercial works really well because you don't see that people are wearing jeans. And you would if it was watch. You would see if they were all drinking Coca-Cola.
Mm-hmm.
And then, since they're all wearing jeans throughout it, they are showing their product constantly. They're just not putting their product in the front. You know, the product is the background.
Yeah.
And the foreground is the scenery and the actions, which is an interesting take on advertising, that the product is the background, but not invisible. It's not that, like, you know, they're doing this, and then at the very last second, you see Coca-Cola. Like, just, the product is in every single shot. It's just backgrounded.
Yeah.
Which is really interesting.
And, yeah, I think that criticism of hers was incorrect, to say the least. Yeah,
to say the least. So, this is interesting. We're going to talk about Levi's again next week because there's a lot more to talk about, and this is a huge, very successful campaign.
Also, a little preview. It involves biking.
Oh, yeah, there's some of that, too.
Yeah. All you other fellow cyclists.
So, we are really interested to hear what people think about this because we want more diversity of opinion. So, go ahead and send us an email at team@thewhitehorsecourier if you've got a lot to say. Otherwise, you can reach us on... That's thewhitehorsecourier.com. You can reach us on Twitter.
Yep.
I'm at Will Imholt.
And I'm at Tom Wixow.
And, of course, you can get us on verbmill.net.
Well, I'm knee-deep in venom. I am. I'm knee-deep in venom. Knee-deep in venom. I am. I'm knee-deep in venom. Knee-deep. Well, I'm lying to you, baby. I'm neck-deep. In venom, neck deep, been venom, I am on neck deep, been venom. she dancing in the water and sliding like a snake. With the poison in her veins and the devil on her face. And the more I spy, the less I lie. Yeah, the more I spy, the less I lie. Closer and making her way. Well, I'm still as a statue and I'm factually praying. But she don't mind, she'll take her time. No, she don't mind, she'll take her time. See you.